Are you a scaling SaaS founder?
Ready to make the leap from leading a team to leading an organization? Join us each week as we refill your think tank with actionable tips and strategies from great business minds you know and those who don't know yet. This is SaaS Fuel with your host, five-time entrepreneur, SaaS founder, and globetrotting adventurer, Jeff Mains.
Welcome back to the SaaS Fuel podcast, where every new beginning is a chance to rewrite our story, this time with more twists, turns, and triumphant endings. I'm your host, Jeff Mains. I hope B2B SaaS founders like you grow from traction to scale. Here, growth is more than just numbers. It's about crafting a future-proof company, premium valuation, and leaders who build a business of significance while living epic, adventurous lives. This week and this weekend is actually one of my favorite holidays. It's the completion of the Christmas story, beginning, end, and beginning. And we have listeners of all faiths and no faiths, and I have friends with a lot of different beliefs and none as well. Now, so diverse, you walk into a bar and the bartender says, "Hey, is this the beginning of a joke?" But we have great, respectful conversations with that I think is super important and a bit of a lost art in today's 140-character attention span world. But whether you look at Jesus as a spiritual figure, a historical person, or as a leadership case study, there's no denying that he made an impact. His life offers profound leadership lessons for the modern world, inspiring teams through service, empathy, and quite a bit more. Now, there are many to choose from, but here are my top three. The first lesson I picked was to lead with compassion. Now, Jesus was known for ministering to society's outcasts, the poor, the sick, the marginalized. Really broke social norms in a lot of ways in doing that. It was like, we don't talk to those people, we don't touch them, but he did anyway. Love was the brand and the mission as well. And as leaders, when we act with empathy and heart, we earn deep loyalty with our people. Such a great lesson to model in the office and in life. Just love people no matter who they are, where they're at. The second lesson is to build a diverse team. And Jesus gathered disciples with varied strengths and weaknesses, from a strong and impulsive Peter to an analytical and financially savvy Matthew. You know, most of us leaders wouldn't have chosen any of this ragtag bunch of hooligans, let alone put them on the same team. If you look at it, it's just ridiculous to think about putting them on that team. But Jesus did. And here's the business lesson that I see. A mosaic of perspectives breeds innovation. You know, value diversity in what each person uniquely offers. Every single person on your team has unique gifts. Find those. Find that diversity. Bring them together. Amazing things happen. And the third lesson is to lead by serving. So this same diverse bunch of guys were arguing about who was the greatest. You know, I am. Oh, no, I am. I'm going to be the best. I'm going to be the greatest. And Jesus said, all right, hold up. If you want to be great, serve. And later, he put it into practice in a really shocking way by washing his disciples' feet. And that was an entry-level job that nobody wanted. Yeah, but what did he do? He flipped status on its head. He empowered others through service. And what's really interesting is that, you know, 2,000 years later, dozens of leadership books have talked about the benefits of serving, servant leadership. Because when leaders focus on helping their team shine, they all rise together. And if you want to be a great leader, serve your team. Of course, the pillars of trust, integrity, and purpose run through the entirety of Jesus' ministry. And like I said, here we are 2,000 years later, his leadership style remains relevant, not for pious reasons, but because it worked. It was effective. It was a great model. His investment in people brought out their best. And there's no more timeless leadership lesson than that. Now, this season, reflect on how you can adopt Jesus' servant leadership ethos to inspire your team to soar. Lead with mercy, embrace all voices, and lift others up. That's how you build a tribe of fanatics who will change the world. We'll just skip the sponsor spot this week, and I'll invite you to church this Easter. Whatever you believe or don't, how about that? Go with a friend, come with me, or check out a service online. You can check out my church home, chaseoaks.org, or Chase Oaks Church on YouTube. Our founder on Tuesday was Jason Friedman, CEO of CX Formula. We talked about growing and scaling businesses with stability, purpose, and energy. The best part was the Kinetic Customer Formula and how going on stadium tours with rock bands gives you different perspective on customer experience. Very cool lessons there. And our expert guest last week was Justin Chi, founder of Cold Email Hackers. Justin shared the latest in what works in email trends and his process for getting the message really dialed in before scaling it up. A lot of us get that backwards. If you missed either one of those episodes, go back and give them a listen. My guest today is Arthur Petropoulos. He founded Hillview Partners in 2016 after a distinguished Wall Street career spanning investment banking, private equity, and corporate development. With a sharp focus on selling, exiting, and securing capital for privately held businesses in diverse sectors, Arthur has led numerous successful transactions, leveraging his deep understanding of the intricacies involved in business sales and capitalization. Welcome someone with a view from the inside, Arthur Petropoulos. Hey, Arthur, welcome to SaaS Fuel.
Jeff, good to be here. Appreciate it.
Tell me a little bit about your journey from Wall Street to founding Hillview Partners. What inspired you to make the transition?
Yeah, sure thing. I appreciate that. So what I'd say is I spent a good amount of a decade in New York, both on the investment banking side, helping companies sell themselves, as well as on the private equity side of buying companies. And the recurring theme that I saw was that companies of a certain size and complexion, so what we kind of define now as privately held businesses making roughly $1 to $10 million a year in pre-tax profit when they're not owned by private equity or not backed by venture capital. When companies like that go to seek an exit or find capital, historically, I always found that to be a very inefficient, very fragmented, slow, distracting, not discrete process. And it was really kind of this donut hole in the system where very small companies had business brokers, much larger companies had traditional larger Wall Street investment banks, but you had this middle ground of middle market, lower middle market situations that we just felt were very underserved. And so we started Hillview Partners with the idea of mitigating these pain points, of solving these issues, avoiding these pitfalls, however you want to phrase it. And that was really the genesis of our company and business.
That's fantastic. And you're exactly right. There's the small business broker, and then there's the giant investment banks. But that middle part in a lot of segments is fairly underrepresented. What do you see as the pitfalls or the things that you solve for companies in that space?
Sure. So I think a lot of the middle market investment banking space, so people that are representing companies, it's a bit more of a reactive process. I think people sometimes think selling a business is like selling a house. You can hang a shingle and put it on a database, and all of a sudden the inbounds are going to come. But in reality, it doesn't happen that way. Businesses have a lot of nuance in that it's not just about fundamentals of what the business earns, but it's what is their access to customers, what are their proprietary capabilities. There's all of these variables. And so in order to really extract the best offer or terms from the market, whether you're selling or looking for capital, you really do have to look at it as an extraction process. So something that is proactive and deliberate, not reactive and waiting. And so what we try to do is kind of craft the narrative around any business that we're working on to really highlight not just, again, the fundamentals, but all of the other variables of the company that make it special. And so that way it can be communicated to the audience as the missing puzzle piece, the reason they should be buying this instead of building it themselves. But that's the main pitfall, is that to get the best results, you have to spell the thesis out to the person that wants to buy it just as well as they would come up themselves, right? So if we show up to a company and say, hey, are you interested in this? If they just said, yeah, maybe, it creates a decent return, that's an okay conversation. But if we went to them and said, you should want this because what you're already trying to build is these things. This is already well developed here. The customer base you're trying to access is already accessed here. And so if you buy this company, you will save X years of time. You'll save Y years, Y dollars and Z brain damage. Then it becomes much more compelling, right? And so it's the pivot from this would be nice to we need this. This could be okay to loss aversion conversation, because in that context or in that lens, that is when something becomes compelling and the terms will reflect that. So there's a lot of pitfalls, you know, from timing, distraction of ownership, not being discrete processes, but the largest one of them is really the concept of making it or pivoting it from a reactive passive process to a proactive, formative extraction of the offers from the market.
And that's so important because that is a delta of millions of dollars, sometimes tens of millions. And, you know, here's this thing that's for sale versus here's why you want it. And that's huge value add.
Precisely. And it's a good point that you pull up is that a recall here is if you were to sell your house yourself, maybe the price would be off, say, 20%. You know, obviously more larger things that are more complex could have more of a delta, but the margin of differentiation in the sale of a house, given it is a fairly commoditized product or a very liquid market in ways, is fairly narrow. But for businesses, you're right. It's multiples of the value oftentimes, where the first bid on a company could be $1 and the final bid could be $3. And so it's that much more important because the bell curve, if you will, is a lot flatter, where there's not, you know, just very well-defined data points of a per square foot basis or a, you know, okay, it's in this neighborhood and this is how big the yard is, versus in a business, there's 1,000 variables. And so getting that right has an outsized impact on the value that you ultimately get and the terms that come with it.
No, without a doubt. What are some other common misconceptions about selling a business?
I think there's conceptions both sides of the spectrum where sometimes it's thought of as very easy, as if it's going to be selling a home and that, oh, you should just get a line of people. And I think what comes along with that is this perception that there's an unlimited depth to the market. So for instance, if you were selling your house in a nice area, there might be 50 people that would want to buy it if the price kept trickling down. So if you say it's kind of a linear regression, right, where if the price comes down, the audience gets bigger. In businesses, particularly where someone does a very niche thing for a niche end market, the depth of market may be 5 people at a good price and then 10 more, but there's a huge chunk in between where we say there's this valley of value. And so if you had 5 people paying a full price for something, there might be 20 people who'd want to buy it if it was half price, but not a lot in between. And so the thought of the ease or the depth of market is sometimes, I think, incorrect. But then at the same time, the other end of the spectrum is a conversation we have sometimes too, where people think it's impossible or who would want to buy this or why would this make sense? I think sometimes business owners in particular have been doing the same thing exceptionally well for a long period of time, almost to the extent that they forget why it's exceptional or that they think, well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to do this. Anyone can do it. But in reality, the brand value, the capabilities, the customer relationships, the client relationships take decades to create. And so there's tremendous value to it. And with the right process of both preparing for a sale as well as facilitating the exit of a business, it can be sold and on very good terms. So I say the conversations we have can sometimes be on either end of that spectrum. Sometimes people thinking it's easier or that there's a deeper market than there is, but just as often people thinking that it's very hard or almost undervaluing what they have as well. So it's our job to bring light to these dialogues and kind of tell people what we see every day and kind of both level set expectations from whether it needs to be more aggressive or less, but ultimately kind of formulating a path towards the objectives.
I like that. I'm sure you see it all over the map where sellers are really undervaluing their businesses. And there's lots of buyers out there that would love that, especially if they don't have representation. And then you have sellers on the other side who think it's worth twice what it really is in the market. How do you balance those two out?
I think it's data is undeniable at some point. And so if we say, okay, well, if it's a company that does this, here's where we're seeing the transactions. Here's where we've had transactions. This is the things that people are going to ask for. These are the pain points. These are the risks, the mitigants, the counter arguments. And so we try to walk a client or a prospective client through what the process is going to be, through what the questions are going to be asked, and then come to what we think internally before we ever go out to market or put forth a engagement letter, what we think the value would be and talk about it. And is that something that's exciting? And is that something compelling? And if it is, then we should pursue it. And if it's not, then we can at least give some advice as to how you could get the business to a direction that the value would be compelling. But that's it. I mean, communication at the end of the day and trying to be clear and transparent and helpful where we can be, both from a data point perspective of what we see in the market and our access to comps and things of that nature, but equally just qualitatively walking through things and both highlighting the good and pointing out where there's areas of improvement.
I like that. So what is it that makes a company sellable and specifically sellable at a premium?
Sure. So I believe it was, and I want to give credit, Marcus Lemonis that had the framework of people, process, and product. And so we think very similarly when looking at a business, as we say, okay, let's look at the people. And so the employees, is there an organizational chart? Who's making what decisions? Is there some level of overlap where there's no single point of failure? And how much of the business still functions in the mind of the founder or the executives, right? And how much has been delegated? And you don't want executives that don't make any decisions, but at the same time, you don't want them to be, you know, the man or the woman with 1,000 arms making every decision, because that is very difficult to transfer. So that's on the people side. On the process side, we break process down into sales, fulfillment or execution, and operations. And so is there a dependable, reliable means of sales? And that can be lots of goodwill and word of mouth, but there should still be at any business some level of outbound effort to generate new sales. And so is there a definable, dependable process on sales? The fulfillment or execution of the business, product or service, how is it being made? How is it being provided? How are clients being handled? As long as that's, again, definable, no single points of failure or limited, then that means it's a well-oiled machine, then that's a good thing. And then product or service or offering, what about it is special, kind of going back to the proprietary element, but also is there some visibility into the future, right? Of saying, okay, what are the next three things you would do with this product, service, or offering to make it even better? Or if money and time were no object, how would it improve? And is there a product roadmap? And I know people think of that from, you know, making iPhones and things like that, but you could have a window cleaning company and say, well, we'd like to add in gutter cleaning. We'd like to work on these types of assets. It could be a simple business, but there has to be some level of thought towards the future. And so when we say one, a business is sellable, it looks like a very well-oiled machine that can be fairly relied upon to produce similar results, if not better, in the future as it has historically. And ultimately, it comes down to those three prongs of people, process, and the ultimate product or service.
I like it. And sometimes companies are looking, one, just to acquire a company and roll it into themselves. But if you look at private equity or VC, sometimes they're looking for a platform company that they can go make additional acquisitions for and roll those in. What makes a company good, a good platform for acquisition?
Sure. So I would say you're highlighting a good point, is that in businesses in the middle market and lower middle market, it's probably the broadest spectrum of any market in terms of prospective acquirers for a business. Because again, if you're small businesses are going to be bought by people, very large businesses are going to be bought by strategics and very large private equity firms. But in our space, it runs the gamut of can be individuals, can be family offices, can be search funds, independent sponsors, can be private equity that does not have a portfolio company, can be a bolt-on to an existing private equity firm that has to an existing portfolio company within a private equity firm, privately held strategics, publicly traded strategics, and on and on. So it is broad. And so some companies can be appealing to multiple of these end parties. But to answer your question more specifically, the companies that are the best suited to become a portfolio company are those that have ownership that wants to stick around for that next season of the business, that has leadership. Because at the end of the day, it's the people component that will drive things forward. No private equity firm has subject matter expertise to just buy a random assortment in an industry. They do need to kind of back a horse, if you will. And so that's something we talk about with our clients. There are some clients that say, I've had enough and I want to retire and cash out everything. There's some clients that say, I would contribute a part of my equity to that roll up, but I don't want to run the whole race. Maybe I'll stick around for a year. And then there's people that say, yeah, that would be awesome. I want to be the portfolio company. I want to drive it. And if they give me a fire hose of money, I'll go buy a ton of stuff. And I have all these ideas. So it depends what season someone is in life. But at the end of the day, it's the people element that will dictate whether it's viable, but then what the people's objectives are will dictate whether it's desirable, right? Whether it's something that they actually want to do.
I think it's important is deciding, you know, what you want to do, what that role is going forward, and figuring out, you know, what does an ideal buyer look like? Because it's not just, you know, anybody. There has to be a right fit. And are there other factors they need to be thinking about in selling of who is a right fit or how the company should be positioned so to be attractive to that kind of buyer?
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, there's certain things that are just universally, like if you want to be a good basketball player, you should be able to run fast and jump high, right? Like there's some things that
sure.
are universal effectively. Right. But yes, there are nuances to everything. And I think depending on, there's known knowns and there's known unknowns and then there's unknown unknowns, right? And so you're right in highlighting that the first conversations or the beginning of the exercise should really be defining the objectives, defining on where you want to be and what you want your life to look like. And then you can kind of back into the different paths that that can take, because a lot of times people think of it as a binary. I can either sell 100% of my business or I can just take on a bunch of debt and retain 100% of equity. But in reality, you could sell 49% of your business. You could sell 51%. You could sell 80% and roll 20% forward and be involved. You could do the same thing and not be involved. There's so many different flavors or points along the continuum that defining the objective is key. And once you do that, if you say, you know what, I would really like it to look like this in the future for what I'm doing with my life, for the seller, what they're going to do, then you can start to define, well, these would be the right parties. And again, then it gets into preference to a degree, where if you sell your company to a large strategic, there's a higher probability that some of your operating expenses will be deemed redundant, and some of your people will be deemed redundant and maybe let go shortly thereafter. Whereas in the private equity world, people are at a premium, and so when they're buying things, they really want to keep more of them. And so I will say, generally speaking, given the lack of talent out there, in the sense that there's more companies wanting to do more things than they can find able-bodied people to do, it's not that same kind of slash and burn as it may have been in the 80s or 90s. But at the same time, depending on what you want the company to be in the future will dictate it. Do you care if the company retains its name? Do you care if the company remains independent? Or do you care if it's part of something bigger? And that really boils down to how people view things. And some are more agnostic, and some are more driven by that legacy component of it. So it's part of the conversation. But I'd say, depending on the fundamentals and the objectives, it will narrow the parties that you'd want to talk to. And then depending on the preferences, it will usually further narrow from there.
And that makes sense. What is it that companies should be thinking about in building a strong foundation? You know, what are those fundamentals? You know, obviously strong finances, but beyond that, you know, what are the strong fundamentals that you look at and you go, this is a company that is going to get a premium because I see value in these specific things?
Yeah. So I think it is, it boils down to the same people, process, and product, but digging further into kind of the product element of that or the service is, why is it elite? Why is it special? And does it have pricing power? And when we say pricing power, it goes back to that Buffett Munger thought relative to durable competitive advantage or a moat or a franchise value, in the sense that somebody will pay, if Coca-Cola is $1.50 and they raise it to $2 and I want a Coke, I'm still going to buy a Coke. If RC Yep. Cola goes from 75 cents to 69 cents and now I can buy Polar Soda for 69 cents, I'm probably just going to buy the cheapest thing. And so we would say, who's competing and on what variables are they competing on, and do they have pricing power? If you buy an Ermeglio Zegna suit, you will pay a certain price because it is that name. But who they outsource to make the suit jacket linings for the inside of their suit jackets is very much driven by price and who can do it for the cheapest while still not scrimping on quality. And so you have to say, where are they in the food chain, and are they competing on price or are they competing on something different? And if we can define it, which most of the times, I put it this way, companies that make $1 to $10 million in profit are almost always have some element that's proprietary, because you can't have a business of that size and not be special. You can't compete on price at a business of that size. I mean, think of like aluminum smelting plants or like lead mines. These things are operating at enormous scale. And so any business that operates on pricing must operate at scale, because it's the only way to really kind of push pricing down. So anything right. That's been historically making $1 to $10 million in profit, you can almost be assured that there's something special. There's something about it that they can price on value on things beyond price. And it's our job to figure that out and highlight it and crystallize it in the narrative.
When you look at, companies and, how do you decide what type of deal is right for you? And explain the options, to the owners of, what their options are for exiting a business. Because it's not just, like you said, I mean, there are other options. It's not just, I'm either going to sell and walk away or not sell. There's lots of options in the continuum. So how do you think about that?
Yeah. So again, starts off with the objectives and what do you want life to look like? And is there more people in your family that want to be part of the business, that want to own a stake of it? What are the long-term objectives? And right. So easy answers are, I want to continue working here for the foreseeable future, in which case we'd say, okay, maybe we sell a minority share or take on some capital, some debt capital. Maybe we sell a majority share, but you become kind of the leader of the portfolio company. Again, if it's within that, you say, well, are your objectives growth or are your objectives just purely a partial monetization of your ownership? And depending on what the objective is. And on the other side, if somebody says, I want to just be done with this and sell out, then we have to start saying, well, is the money immediately that important that you want 100% of it day one? And sometimes that's the case. And if not, and they say, well, you know, I've already been taking money out of the business for 25 years. It's not, well, you know, it's meaningful, but it's not going to materially change my day to day. Well, then we'd say, well, why don't we find a partner that could be a good steward of a portion of that capital for the next 7 years? Because private equity tends to underwrite their deals to, say, a 20% IRR. If you could get that kind of a return on, say, 20% of the equity that someone's going to pay for your business, then that can be a meaningful investment where that 20% could be worth more than the 80% by time 7 years and 8 years rolls by. And so it's again, objectives first, and then boiling down into what does that subset look like? What are the preferences look like? But at the end of the day, there's certain businesses that will allow you to have certain types of exits or monetizations, and there's certain that won't. So that's a bit of the gating issue. If you have a company that makes $1 million in EBITDA or pre-tax profit, it's difficult to find someone who's going to buy a minority share in that because it's just not sizable enough where they feel like they're going to have enough control. Because and they'll always tell us, you know, there's no small problems with small businesses. And so it becomes a harder conversation. If someone has a company that's making $10 million a year in EBITDA, it's a lot easier to sell 30% of that business because they feel like there's an adequate critical mass to do so. And so I think we always say, like, looking at the business fundamentals, what subset to that does that allow to be an option? And then based on what the available options are, where do your preferences point along that spectrum?
Yeah. In SaaS world, a lot of times valuations are based on revenue, not profit, historically, because there hasn't been a lot of profit, but that's changed over the last year or so. I mean, fundamentals actually do matter. Surprise, surprise. So what role do you think profit plays in you know, capital efficient growth in looking at SaaS acquisitions going forward?
My angle is that if it can be done, it can be done profitably. And, you know,
exactly.
Vista Equity and Thoma Bravo would seem to agree. Now, Jeff Bezos ran an unprofitable company for 20 years or whatever it was. And now he's, you know, in Miami with a beautiful weather woman as his new wife or whatever. But, you know, won't get into that. But point is, it's a perspective. I like to say you should grow a business agnostic to the outside world, because I think another Buffett-ism was, you know, running a business with a lot of leverage is like driving a car with a knife sticking out of the steering wheel. You're going to drive very carefully, but at some point there's going to be a cow in the road. And so you're taking an angle. And when I think of an unprofitable company growing, it is leverage of a sort, because you are basically leveraging the idea that the capital markets will support you through all of this unprofitable growth. And that has turned out phenomenally well for some businesses that kind of ran into the upswing and sold off. And then now it's proving to be horribly bad for some companies that are, you know, taking in new capital at a tenth of their last valuation, or, you know, seeing the stock price plummet. And so what I think is my advice to anybody, and I'm certainly not Jeff Bezos, would be, if you can grow a company profitably where the focus on profit does not inhibit the growth, then you can be much more agnostic of the macroeconomic environment. Whereas otherwise, you're taking a roll of the roulette wheel that by time you are wanting to exit, that the market's going to be there to support you. If you're making profit, you can wait until the market's there. If you're not making profit, you're just at the behest of your investors. And if they decide to you know, when the VC portfolio is looking at, okay, here's our 12 companies, these three are winners, these three are losers. When they're looking at the six in the middle, you know, their decision to shoot you or not is sometimes that's it. They decide your fate. And I just don't like leaving the fate of a company in someone else's hands besides the owner of it. That's my, you know, frugal Greek nature, I suppose. But that's kind of where I tend to fall out from, if you ask my opinion on it.
I'm right there with you. And you know, any business can be profitable. And I like the way that you phrase that, where it doesn't inhibit growth. I think that's an important consideration, because there are some where you really want to capture market share, but you don't have to run at a big negative. You can run at a break even. It doesn't have to be a giant profit if you're really in growth phase, but having that balance.
Right. And if you understand the unit economics and we always say you really want to understand what's your core operating costs. So like every year, what's going to be the expenses that you have to cover, and then understand your unit economics. And so if you're selling a pencil for $1 and it makes you 50 cents on a unit basis, but your overhead for the whole business is $1,000, well, you know, you need to sell at least 2,000 pencils in the year to cover it. And is that reasonable expectation? But once you know that, then yeah, you could keep putting more money, redeploying capital into marketing. And I think of marketing and outbound and lead gen and all of that as the more modern version of kind of capital expenditures that you used to see in a widget factory 100 years ago.
Definitely, yeah.
And so I'm all for, like, understand unit economics, understand your core operating expenses, then understand what's left over. If you want to redeploy it into marketing to get market share, great. But you also need to be able to turn that off and be profitable should the situation warrant. So I guess you bring up a very good point, where it's not no growth. It's not even slow growth. It's just intelligent growth.
Yeah. Yeah. So what would you say about a company that doesn't necessarily have good unit economics today, but they're convinced that, you know, when they're selling 1,000 pencils and losing money, but they're convinced when they sell 5,000 that they'll finally get to the point of profitability? We hear stories like that all the time.
Yeah, I mean, again, a very old-fashioned saying is it's hard to make money selling $10 bills for $8.
And it is.
And similarly, there was an old cartoon that used to say, "Hey, boss, we lost $1. We lose $1 on every widget." And the boss says, "Don't worry, we'll make it up in volume." And so yeah. I'll believe it if there's a convincing argument. Like, just to say, hey, if we sell enough of these watches, then they'll be popular enough that we can increase the price. I don't buy it, because you really don't have a good way of demarcating at which point you will become profitable. If you alternatively, you said, well, if I sell 500 of these prototypes of this thing that are this expensive to make, and I can get orders in for 1,000 of them, then I can dramatically decrease the cost of manufacturing the prototypes or the sales product. Well, then you can start getting into like the probabilities of getting there. But I think there has to be, if you're going to lose money on your way to profitability, you better have a very good story, because, you know, I can eat potato chips every day saying I'm going to be in shape by the time Christmas comes around, just do weight. And if you saw me working out every day or being profitable, you'd have a lot more confidence. So I'm not saying it doesn't happen, yes, but I would want a compelling narrative as to why that's going to be the case.
I think that's so important, is really having that compelling narrative. And, you know, not only you believing that it's true, but being able to convince other people, investors and others around there that is a likely scenario, that here's the path out, here's the path to profitability.
Right. You're absolutely right. And it's not to throw cold water on early stage companies or anything like that, because I do strongly believe that they are innovators, and even the companies that we're working with that may be a further along in the seasons of their business have been largely the innovators that ultimately find their way up to the larger companies. I mean, that's how most large companies are not innovating. They are buying people that have innovated. And so that's the way that this food chain works. I just think you need to be prudent, and you can't be a dreamer. There's an oxymoron or a quagmire or whatever you want to call it in a paradox of business. You must be a dreamer to start a business. You must have vision to start a business, but you must not be a dreamer when it comes to running the business. And that's why oftentimes you see when a business gets to a certain size, they bring in CEOs and COOs, and sometimes the leadership changes. But I think the early innings of a business where you're not big enough to bring in those people, you have to have a really good mix. I always call it the straight eights system, right? You don't have to be a 10 at anything, but you got to be an 8 at everything. And so you could be the world's greatest idea person, but if you have no idea what you're doing with money, you know, I don't care if you drown in the middle of a lake or 5 feet from the other side of the shore, you still drown. And so
right.
It's this balance. And that's the people who I've seen have been the most successful have the creative gene, but they also have the pragmatic gene. And you know it when you see it.
Yes. Yes. And how do co-founders work together in that? You know, Rocket Fuel is a great book and talks about having you the visionary and the operator. And so really having those two specific roles, have you seen that work really well? Or how do you see co-founders work together to kind of balance each other out and fill in those weaknesses that the other person has?
I think it increases the probability of success in many situations. I think you can have a very, very successful singular person running and owning a company, but it's more likely. If I were to say to you, Jeff, find me someone who's great with numbers, and I also want you to find me someone who's great with sales, you could go out there and find someone who does it. But if I said, find me someone who's great with sales and great with numbers, it'd be a lot harder to find. So the probability that you're going to fuse two people where the rocks in one person's brain fill the holes in the other person's, right? It's much more probable. And so I think, I forget if it was Y Combinator, there's a handful of these early VC funders, some of the larger ones, where they just won't invest in something unless there are more than one founder. Now, they want them all to be involved with the business, but a lot of times people don't like the singular owner because of the rarity of having all of those skill sets. And so a lot of times, I would say the world is split between painters and carvers, right? There's the painter who's kind of putting the image and the vision together, and there's the carver who's chiseling it down all day into something that's practical, that has utility. And so that's what we look for when there's multiple owners. I think there's too many chefs in the kitchen spoil the broth, but when you see multiple people that have worked together for a very long time, you can very quickly define which side of the brain each one is focusing on and how it all comes together. So it can be a very good thing in many situations.
Yeah. Well, let's continue talking about that, just the people aspect. We kind of hit process, kind of hit product. And what about the people? What is it about the people and the team that adds significant value to a company when investors or acquirers come in and look at that and go, wow, this is something that is really special?
I think from one perspective, it is leverage in the sense that people can do a lot of things, and if they are talented, they can do many things. And so you have leverage to support the ongoing growth of the business. And so the idea of operating leverage to say, we have a wonderful team of people that could do three times as much business as we're currently doing, well, then that really expands profit margin going into the future. I think addition to that, people can be a source of innovation within the company. If you have people that are so involved and excited to be there that they are focusing on improving the product and improving the service every day. And so if you have this kind of ongoing improvement, that can be very compelling as well. And then I think the avoidance of material. So those are the upside scenarios, if you will. And then I think buyers will always look at the downside protection as well as, well, if this function of the business has three people that are all capable of doing it, then we feel fairly confident that if one person leaves, we'd be able to backfill that situation. And so does it provide a buttressing or a support to the ongoing of the business? And so that's one side of the equation, is kind of what's compelling about the people to an acquirer, but then you have to say what's compelling about the acquirer to the people, what's compelling to the owner about the people, because people can vote with their feet these days more than they ever could. And so they're only going to stick around. And so we say that I may be called insensitive, but I don't focus on happiness. I don't focus on whether people are happy. I focus on whether they are properly motivated and incentivized, because ultimately if they are incentivized to do something that is positive for the company, and then they are rewarded for doing that positive thing for the company, then they will be happy. And so the focus needs to be on setting proper goals and setting proper incentives. And it was Charlie Munger said, show me an incentive and I'll show you an outcome. And so what I always say when we look at a company where someone says the people are no good or the people are a problem, like the seller or a prospective seller saying, oh, I've got a problem, it's much less of a people problem and much more of a you problem, much more of a the motivations and the incentives aren't aligned. So if you motivate someone to not work hard, and then they don't work hard, then they get hit with a stick because they didn't work hard, it's this negative reinforcement of sorts that just leads to a terrible situation. But if you can incentivize and motivate for someone to do something good, and you don't have to be Mr. Rogers to do, you know, I'm saying it doesn't always have to be rah-rah speeches and, you know, hugs and sing-alongs. Like, it can just be like, look, guys, we need to make profit and we want to drive this business forward. But if you can incentivize it and reward it and reaffirm it in a consistent and reliable way, then that will be a very appealing thing. So oftentimes, if we see a good workforce for any particular company, whether it's softwares or sausages, you know, what we say is that is truly, and as a buyer says, it is truly indicative of good ownership, because it means that they are properly incentivizing people, that they are reliable as owners, that they are not all over the place and unpredictable, and that there's an environment that supports both the ongoing improvement of the business as well as just the consistent performance. And so from a buyer's perspective, it's, you know, looking at the workforce of a business tells you a lot. And those are kind of some of the highlights that we see both from the buyer's perspective and then also from a seller, how they're managing it and what those things should be that they're trying to solve for as well.
That's good. When we talk about, you know, motivation and aligning incentives, I think sometimes from the outside, or maybe, you know, leaders will say, you know, we need to grow revenue, we want to grow profit. And that's not a real incentive for people, but, you know, tying it to like a meaningful outcome for them and incentivizing, you know, that outcome is so much more powerful than just, you know, we want to grow revenue. Well, why? I mean, everybody kind of wants that. They get it. They like to see the number go up, but it doesn't affect their day-to-day life. And that's the difference in having a real incentive.
I agree. I think if you have a long-term goal, there should be 50 incremental goals within it. Why do people like video games so much? Right? Because you finish the level, you get to the next stage, your character gets enhanced, but there's very perceptible, tangible, incremental improvements along the way. Now, if we just go in front of the people that work for us and say, we're going to knock it out of the park, and 5 years from now, we're going to be 5 times revenue. Now, that's all great, but if you said, in the next 3 months, I want all of the people doing outbound outreach for our company to do, you know, 1.25 as much, and focus again on the inputs, right? Or we want our service, you know, to be performed this way, or this, you know, this particular process to be followed every single time. If you can somehow tell people who work for you that I want either the inputs or the outcomes, the inputs or the outputs to hit these targets in very short time frames and much more lockstep or bite-sized goals, then the incentive comes along with that, because it's a much quicker feedback loop. And the quicker, even if the long-term feedback loop is a huge, audacious goal, if you can make small, quicker feedback loop targets along the way, it incentivizes. And I would say the really, really good people we've seen, they don't even predicate it on output. So if they say, it's easy to say to your salesperson, like, I want you to sell twice as much next year, but there's obviously a randomness to it to some degree that's going to disincentivize and say, well, I can't force the people to do the thing. But what you can do is you can quantify how many meetings you take. You can quantify how many outbound emails you write, how many phone calls you take or make. And so we always say the best businesses have short-term goals, quick feedback loops, and predicated on inputs, not outputs, because you can define, right? If I said, you know, Jeff, get up every morning and do 50 push-ups, it'd be easier than saying, Jeff, I want you to have, you know, be able to, I don't know, bench press 800 pounds by time next year rolls around, right? Because one thing is inputs, one's outputs. Like, I don't know how fast your strength's going to grow. I don't know how, you know, improved you will become over that time. All I know is if you do the inputs consistently, you will improve. But that's the way we like to think of it. If it's inputs, I can measure it. And it's almost impossible that if you select the right inputs and then do them consistently, it's almost impossible not to hit the target. But it's just way more tangible and communicable, right? Nobody likes it when their boss pounds in a room and says, everyone has to get better, sell more, cut expenses, make more profit, you know, hire better people. It's like, great, but what does that mean, right? It's like, you know, your wife says, I want you to be nicer. It's hard. To say, what does that mean? Like, you know, and it's like not to, you know, you can't quantify everything to say smile 3.6 times every 8 hours.
Right.
But the closer you can get to that, the more it's aligned, I think.
I think that's really, really good to look at it that way, because outcomes and the outputs, that's all backward looking. And we can't really change that. It's something that's, you know, we're there and we're looking back. Did we meet it or did we not? Inputs are forward looking. So that's something that we can control right now. And I know that if I measured on inputs and I'm doing that, that outcomes will come, because we've figured that out. What are the inputs required to get that output? Because we've broken it down and actually put some thought into it. You know, what does getting better look like? What is being nicer? You know, how does that happen? You know, what do you do? But, you know, you quantify that and it's forward looking, which I think is always more motivating, thinking about a goal and reaching something instead of, you know, getting to it and then looking back. Okay, what do we do?
I agree. And I think also it takes a level of leadership and responsibility for leadership. When you say to someone, I want you to do these things, maybe their response is going to be, well, I don't know if that's going to generate the outcome we're looking for. And there's a conversation. It's not to say it's going to generate a bad outcome, but if you say, I want to increase sales and I'd like you to make this many more calls, I'd like you to take this many more meetings because our target is this. If the person says, I don't know if that's all going to equate to hitting that target, you take the input, but to some extent you can say, well, that's okay. My job is to set those targets. My job is to, if I set a target and you do the inputs that I ask you to do and we don't hit the target, that's my fault. I either didn't set the target right or I didn't give you a good enough path to follow that you could achieve it. So I think by virtue of focusing on the inputs to the support team of a company, ownership or leadership is taking responsibility to say, we are going to be the arbiters of the outputs and we are going to take responsibility for what the outcome is. And I think that's empowering to people because they don't have to feel the pressure of setting the target and accomplishing it, right? You have people that are working hard enough to do the things you ask them to do. You don't also need them to be, you know, postulating on what the business is supposed to be and everything like that. That's what strong leadership is supposed to be. So it's this balance of delegating tasks while retaining leadership. And it's all very interesting. It gets into a lot of kind of human psychology to some degree, but it's true. And I just say, a motivated person is someone who has clear inputs, clear tasks to accomplish, and a good feedback loop to it, and a faith that their superior or their boss or owner or whatever has enough leadership and self-accountability that they're not going to get lambasted because leadership didn't do its job as best as it could have.
Right, right. Well, where can people learn more about you online?
Sure. So I'd say, our website currently is hillviewps.com. So P's and Peter, S's and Sam. We actually just bought, I'm happy to say, the domain for hillview.com. So within a few weeks, it's a lot simpler. And then so on our website, we have kind of our breakdown overview, representative clients. And it does have some of our videos, but we are creating videos twice a week on selling your business, finding capital, steps, things to look out for. And that's on a YouTube channel. If you type in Arthur Petropoulos, you'll find that. I've got about 150 videos out now. We're putting two out every week. Same videos are on LinkedIn, so people can find us on LinkedIn as well. Those are our three main channels. We do not have the Hillview TikTok account quite yet, and I don't know if that will ever materialize.
We'll see.
But at this point, our website, YouTube, LinkedIn, and we're always happy to chat with people, whether they're looking to do something now or down the track.
Outstanding. We'll make sure and link all of that in the show notes. And congratulations on hillview.com. That's very cool. It's a great pickup.
Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure being here. And I appreciate you letting me chat your ear off for a bit. This is good.
Absolutely. Thanks, Arthur. Thanks for being on SaaS Fuel.
Be well.
Thanks again, Arthur, for coming on the show and sharing your wisdom and insights. You can learn more about Arthur and Hillview Partners at hillviewps.com. As always, all links, highlights, resources, and full show notes are available at sasfuel.com. And of course, check us out on YouTube as well. And then bounce on over to the Chase Oaks Church channel also. If you found value in this episode, pay it forward by sharing it with someone else who could benefit from it. Everyone who shares this week gets a Morning Magic mug. It's a coffee cup that changes colors with the sunrise, so you can literally drink in the beauty of the new day. Join us next Tuesday, where our founder is Joran Hoffman, founder of Reditus. He created a SaaS to manage affiliate programs for SaaS companies. everything you want to know about tapping into a large sales force. And next week on our SaaS Fuel Expert Series, we have Asia Arangio from Demand Maven, growth consultant that helps SaaS, software, and internet-based companies troubleshoot their growth, identify new growth opportunities, and do demand generation. So I will see you next time. Till then, happy Easter, and as always, enjoy the journey.
Thanks for listening to SaaS Fuel. Full show notes for each episode, which includes a summary, key takeaways, quotes, and any resources mentioned, are available at saasfuel.com. Be sure to follow and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're enjoying the content and getting value from these episodes, please leave us a rating and review at ratethispodcast.com/SaaSFuel. We'll be sure to read these out on future episodes. Let's go.